Luxicult is a part of the Green Mushroom Podcast Network.
Sunday for victory. Monday for trouble. Tuesday for trials. Wednesday for earth. Thursday for flame. Friday for money. Saturday for luck. I read that saying in Icelandic Folk Magic, Witchcraft of the North by Albert Scheele. Hello and welcome to Luxicult. This is the podcast where we gleefully taunt the mundane, butcher the Latin and most other languages, and we also discuss a variety of occult, esoteric, and adjacent concepts, exploring the intersections of magic, art, science, technology, philosophy, and so much more. This is occultism for everyone. I'm Lux Estrada, and if you can hear the sound of my voice right now, then that means that this show and magic are for you, if you want them. There are a lot of different ways to be more free in the world, and using magic or making space for a spiritual practice in your life can be one of them. As always, I don't speak for anybody but myself. Others can, will, and should disagree with me sometimes. How will we ever learn anything if we were all in agreement on all things all the time after all? And like those who attempt to be reasonable should be willing to do, I am willing and often do change my opinions based on new evidence. Alright, really stoked to bring you a great conversation I had with Albert Bjorn Scheele about his new book, Icelandic Folk Magic, Witchcraft of the North. We get into all sorts of interesting topics, including Galdr and Sidir, and the complex gender stuff that goes along with these terms. I really like the idea of magic as song. It comes up in a lot of traditions, and we get into a little bit of that here. We talk about Odin's complex role in all of this, and about how some of these things played out in history. The idea that Christianity is a big part of Icelandic folk magic comes up, and Jesus enters the chat. Albert also disabuses us of some common misconceptions about Icelandic magic and its origins. Spoiler alert here, it's not really Viking stuff, even though people like to think that it is. He also talks about the complex role that figures like Jesus and even Agrippa might play in the work of Icelandic folk magicians. We talk a little bit about trolls, the elves, and the other denizens of the wild places, the hidden people, as well as the practice of sitting out. Albert shares about his process in developing some of the magical workings available in the book, and we get into some other fun and interesting territory besides. I think people are really going to enjoy it. And if all that weren't enough, I have another rad conversation to share with you all today. During an episode within the episode, Omega of Omega Decay Video talks with me about a book he has written recently anonymously published called Fables and Chimeras, which is about alchemy, and he will share a little bit about the research that went into that. We also get into Santa Muerte and hear some of Omega's thoughts about working with her, as well as about some of the alchemical symbolism associated with her. He also shares about how using non-violent communication techniques can lead to both better social relationships and more effective magical operations. He also shares some perspectives about approaching a magical practice from a decidedly unacademic standpoint, which I think is a really cool and important thing to hear about. Magic and occultism offer so many rich and interesting veins of research for the bookish and nerdy, scholastically inclined person like me, but that can sometimes be easy to forget that the actual practice of doing these things is often taking place in a very different type of psychological space or accessing a very different way of knowing than the sort of analytical means of research and book learning. Magic is something that all humans have access to, and you don't need special hard-to-find ingredients or texts or anything like complex charts or formulas to do it. This is one of the fun, cool things about looking into folk magics from a lot of different traditions, which kind of brings me full circle back to the first guest who we're going to be hearing from shortly. If you like this show or the other work I've been getting into, you can support it on Patreon. If you do so, you can take a bibliomancy break with me, and there are no tiers or levels, so give as you will. Buy me a coffee is also an option for those who wish to show their one-time support with a donation but don't want to go through the whole Patreon rigmarole. Your support makes the show possible by allowing me to cover the expenses associated with making it, thereby justifying the time I spend to myself. I really do appreciate the opportunity to be making this thing, and of course having the resources necessary to do that is an integral part of that equation. So thank you so much to everybody who is making that possible. Although I'm a pretty introverted person and I don't use social media all that often, I'm not there all the time checking on things, so please don't be alarmed if it takes me a while to get back to you. This does not mean that I don't want to hear from people or anything like that. I'm beyond lucky to have such amazing listeners, collaborators, cohorts, co-conspirators, etc. I always welcome people's thoughts, questions, comments, suggestions, or arcane revelations. If you'd like to reach out to me with something for listener mail, you can get me at luxoccultpod@gmail.com, or you can find me on Instagram at luxoccultpod. We're going to be hearing some listener mail and shoutouts a little bit later on after the interviews. Speaking of which, my first guest today, Albert, lives in downtown Reykjavik, Iceland, where he spends his days writing and researching magic, and his nights sitting out on the mounds and nature spaces around him. Born and raised in Sussex, England, he blends the folk magic of Sussex with that of his new homeland. Author of two books on Icelandic plant and folk magic, respectively, his work primarily concerns Icelandic magical staves, plant magic, and planetary magic, which he blends with the Icelandic tradition he is initiated in. He can be found on social media as Sussex_Pilar, on Instagram, and Albert Bjorn Scheel on Facebook. He teaches classes, workshops, and courses both in person as well as online, all of which can be found at his website, www.pilarcrafts.com. That's P-E-L-L-A-R, crafts.com. There will be links to that stuff in the show notes. I'll be back in a bit to introduce the episode within the episode featuring Omega to talk about fables and chimeras, Santa Muerte, alchemy, nonviolent communication, and more. But now let's get into Icelandic folk magic, witchcraft of the north, with Albert Bjorn Scheel. Well, my guest today is Albert Bjorn Scheel. How's it going today?
Yeah, great. It's actually the first day of summer here in Iceland. So it's like a, what's it called? In the UK, it's called a bank holiday. I don't know if that's the same term everywhere else, but basically everything is closed and there's been like a big parade through town.
Oh, great. That sounds awesome. Yeah. I was actually lucky enough to visit Iceland maybe about 5 or 6 years ago over the Christmas time, and it was so fun. It was an absolutely gorgeous place. I would definitely go back.
Nice.
So we're here to talk about your book, Icelandic Folk Magic, Witchcraft of the North. All right, very cool. So I'm curious to hear about your journey into writing this very cool book.
Yeah, honestly, I think mostly it's been luck. So I moved here in 2017. I'm originally from the UK, but I moved here in 2017. And I think I just fell in with the right people. Like it's a very small place, and nepotism is a huge thing here, for better and for worse. knowing the right people really gets you into all the right places. And I think honestly, I was just very lucky to meet the right people who were into the same sort of thing as me with folk magic and more sort of traditional folkloric witchcraft. And yeah, just meeting people who knew about that here. More than because you have the like runes, I think I don't tend to see them as much used by new agey things, but here it's very like people are still doing very, very old stuff, or like things that can be traced back very far. And I think I was just lucky to meet the right people who knew these things and were happy to teach as well. I think that's been the main reason I know what I know, is because I've been lucky enough to be liked by people who knew and know these things as well. Yeah, I think it's mainly luck, like, to be honest.
Well, so much is, that makes sense. So you have a pretty like solid basis in grimoire stuff though before you got into that, is that right?
Yeah, so I started, well, I think like the very beginning I started more plant magic. So in Sussex, when I was living in Sussex growing up, I was more into Wicca. And then from Wicca more into like a heavily like plant focused practice. And then going more into ceremonial magic, grimoire tradition, and then learning the runes a little bit. So I was sort of doing lots of different things, but it was much more, what I was doing in Sussex was a bit more rigid sort of grimoire tradition stuff. And then moving more into the sort of I think like more free-flowing folk magic. Like I was doing quite a bit of folky stuff in Sussex as well, but I tried to be quite rigid in my practice back then. Now I'm much more sort of free-flowing with folky things and just learning, learning to do what fits and what feels good, but more or less still lines up with planetary magic and like systems like that. So
Yeah,
it's a bit
very.
all over the place.
Yeah, no, it makes a lot of sense though. One of the things I really enjoyed about the book was this weaving story, this weaving path that this tradition takes through all of these different, kind of like sidebars as people were, coming to the place and, use like the whole idea of these like wizard priests and everything, people from like bringing these other traditions into it. And I love the way that that's mirrored in your story. It's really cool.
Yeah, I didn't really think about that, to be honest, but I think that makes quite a lot of sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's get into it here. Let's get into first the differences between Galdr and Sidhir. Can we talk a little bit about what these terms mean and what practices they refer to and all of the complexity that surrounds all of that?
So Galdr is typically the way that we try to break it down, because you have like the gender binary between these two things, which like we at the moment in my group at least, we're very much trying to do away with lots of gender binary stuff. Typically you would have Galdr as like the sort of more men's magic. It's the more sort of rigid, so runes and spoken charms, some songs, not all songs but some songs. And then also the more sort of rigid staves, Icelandic magical staves, that sort of thing. Stuff that's more sort of, I guess, conscious versus subconscious of like very rigidly defined things tend to be Galdr. So you have songs that have a very clear start, a very clear finish. You have staves that, can be like any sort of concept, any goal. But what you're essentially doing is snatching this idea out of the ether, putting it in a very rigid box of this stave that then does this thing or helps move towards this goal. So Galdr is more, typically more rigid, more sort of traditionally men's magic. And then you have Seidr, and Seidr is the more sort of it tends to it's because it can be quite an umbrella, but also academically there's not a huge amount that's agreed on upon what it was in the past. But it's typically seen as the more sort of women's arts, so lots of stuff to do with weaving, fortune telling. Lots of songs, but more sort of more vocalizations and more these very long flowing songs that you can sort of loop around and around and around and keep going for a very long time. Seidr is more sort of the magic of things like weather magic, things that are a bit more free flowing and harder to box and control. I think that's the most simple way that I can break it down. And interestingly, like in the past, to be a man who was performing Seidr, that was typically a women's art. That was seen as quite an othering and quite a queer thing to do as well, which is quite cool for me
Yeah,
personally.
right on. Yeah, let's get into that a little bit because I love the perspective that you take there.
For me, I typically would use the word Seiðkart to describe what I do, what I am. And this is a man who practices Seiðr, but it's not typically Seiðr is not like the Seið in Seiðkart is not like typically just I'm only doing Seidr, like I'm doing lots of other things as well. Seidr to create something like that. It also that word can mean like craft or like a brew or something that you've created. And I like that then as a term for me as well, because I'm doing a bunch of different stuff and sort of I'm in like quite an experimental phase where I'm like mixing quite a few different things together and seeing what happens, which is quite fun.
Yeah, I love that.
But
Okay.
but typically, like in the past, at least in the Viking Age, if you were a man who was practicing Seidr, you were often seen. There's a term, erki, which is like it's a derogatory term used. Like most often, it's agreed on that it's used as like a sort of like a queer slur at the time. Like it was an old like it was a bad word in the past of like if you're a man who's practicing Seidr, then you are erki, like you're fulfilling a traditional women's role. Which like has interestingly has like a bunch of like bottom shaming connotations for gay men,
Fascinating.
but it's really interesting as well, because when you think of like how woven into magic queerness is, or just not just queerness but this otherness
Sure,
and like liminal spaces of not really fitting into one box, it's really interesting to sort of break all of that down. But yeah, Erki is that like more simply it's being reclaimed now, which I love. But more simply, Erki was like is a man who is practicing a woman's art, which also very interestingly, like Odin as the king of the gods, he was also considered. I mean, if you go by the if you go by the definition of what Erki meant, he would have been considered Erki as well because he was practicing Salish and he learned this from, in the stories at least, we know that he learned this from Freya, the goddess. So it's interesting that you have like at the time people being like quite rigid about like, oh, this is a bad thing, yet like the sort of head of many, at least in Iceland he wasn't the sort of highest god, they think, but in many other places he was the, I mean, he is the all father, he is the highest of the gods in the Norse pantheon, this figure of seemingly like prime manliness would technically have been classed as this as well. So it's really interesting that that people tend to forget that when they think
Yeah, that is really
about Erki and stuff
fascinating.
like that.
So I'm curious, is the term, is it still like used in a modern context? Is this word still like around?
I mean, some people know what it means still. It's being reclaimed more for like, at least in Iceland. Like I'm quite lucky to be like a part of quite a big queer group that are all practicing. We're using it because it's fun, and we're reclaiming this term, which you know maybe doesn't actually need to be reclaimed because it's so old that a lot of people don't know what it means in the first place anymore.
Okay, that makes sense. I was curious if it was like still part of the common vernacular or if it is sort of like more specialized now. That makes sense. Very cool. So I really love what you wrote about the Huldufólk. I hope I'm saying that somewhere close to right. When I was in Iceland, the tradition of the Yule lads was something that I'd heard about for the first time, and I really enjoyed it. And there was just so much magic. It was a really, really rich tradition. So I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about your relationship with all of these friends, hopefully, and what that looks like.
Yeah, so like with like the hidden people, I think at least to compare it to more like well-known examples of fairy folk and things like this, the relationship that we tend to have with them is more similar to Irish people's relationship to the Fae in Ireland. So you have these places that are like renowned, like respected for being elf stones or elf settlements, and these are places that you don't tend to. You don't do stuff there. You leave it alone. It's their space. There's like a quite a deep respect for that, which is really interesting as well, because a lot of people who don't even really believe in it will have this thing of like, oh no, you know, we can't go there. And then they're questioned about it, and it's like, okay, so do you? You must believe in this a little bit because you seem scared to
Sure.
interact with this place. So it's quite a deep cultural thing, which is very cool. But we have, we have. So there's the Huldufólk. We have the hidden people. Then there's also the Alvar, the elves, which often they're lumped together, but I tend to look at them as slightly different. You have the hidden people that have been sort of spirits in the land forever. And then you have the elves, the Alvar, who, if depending on what source you take as more credible, there's this idea of people after death, people walking into the hills and walking into the mountains to become these sort of ancestor spirits of the land. And there's quite a lot in elf lore, there's quite a lot of that, at least in more of the written sources of these are the ancestors of the ancient people, like the Thortmen. You know, Thorn men is like the old word for this, like ancient people who were the ones who probably then walked into the mountains and the hills and became the elves. But it's very vague, and I think during like because a lot of what I'm working off is more sort of 19th and 20th century folklore inspired by stuff like 17th century and earlier as well. But you have this sort of weird mix of a bunch of stuff that you then need to look back through and sort of pick apart and think like, oh, okay, so we have this source that's maybe much, much older that says this thing about this group of people who walked into the hills. But then by more recent times, you have a lot of these things being smushed together. So it depends on what your sort of personal relationship with them is, I guess. But in general, what I've noticed, so from like growing up in the UK, it tends to be at least that like, you know, you hear folklore of all these things, and there's a certain like a black dog running around on the hills near your house, or your village has its ghosts and stuff. And there's similar stuff in Iceland of the villages, like ghosts of the village and elves that live in the rock down the street, that sort of thing. But like the respect for it is obviously it's that stayed here for like a lot longer than in the UK, and in much of Europe. At least I feel like it's much more present because you still have so many people believing in it, and you know whether they're like fully invested in that belief or not, they're still it's still like part of society here. So it's really our relationships with these things here are like quite a bit more intense, at least in my experience from growing up in the UK. But yeah, we have the hidden people, we have the elves, trolls as well. There are certain places that we don't go because they belong to the trolls. Certain plants that we don't take because they're troll plants. So you, it's there's a lot about like not wanting to like incur the wrath of these spirits.
Interesting. Could you tell me a little bit about these troll plants?
So there's quite a few. Well, so there are certain plants with like trut in the name, which is the word for troll.
Okay.
So you have yeah, like trutslager, which is I think it's red lousewort in English. I don't remember the Latin, but that's one plant that is typically belongs to trolls. And the folklore around it as well says that like if you use this plant in like making mattresses with dried grasses and things, if you include this in that, then the people who sleep on this mattress will get lice because the trolls will give them lice essentially. So there's
That's
loads of really random
fascinating.
stuff like that.
Yeah, I love that. I would love to like take a sort of taxonomic look at these troll plants and see if there's anything they have in common. I'm kind of a plant nerd myself, and so yeah, that's so fun. I love it.
It's really interesting, like because it's also there are the plants that are called troll plants, but then there are also plants that we sort of deduce whether they belong to trolls or not based on the area that they live in and where they're growing, also how they're growing. If like lots of plants are growing quite stunted, then we you know that could be one example of a place that belongs to the trolls because the trolls are or trolls and trollish energy in general tends to be more of a sort of, you know, not like anti-life, but like it's you get plants growing in these areas that are quite stunted or look a bit weird or feel a
Yeah.
bit malnourished. It's this sort of
I love
not
that.
negative as in like evil, but it's like the sort of not decay even as well, but just this other energy that needs to exist in the universe.
Sure, like a limiting kind of
But
energy, like almost Saturnian in a way or something like that. Just a sort of,
absolutely.
yeah, okay. Yeah, I'm thinking about, above tree line. I grew up in Colorado. So, if you could go up above tree line and you could see all the alpine plants, which were so cute, they were sort of like little miniature versions of what you would find down lower. And yeah, very fun. Okay. So, getting into the sort of like dual practices that a lot of people have, I'm hoping we can talk a little bit about the Christian takan, the taking of Christianity, and how that kind of influenced how Icelandic folk magic looks.
Yeah, absolutely. It's so like Christianity is quite central to lots of Icelandic folk magic. So you have in what was it the year 1000? The year 1000. That's when Iceland was settled between 800 and 900. So it was only really pagan for about 100 years. And then you have I forget his name, the leader at the time of the people who supposedly went and sat in a room for 3 days and then came out and was like, oh yeah, Jesus is the God, which is interesting because those 3 days of sitting inside mirror the 3 days of Jesus
Yeah.
dying and then being resurrected. So it's there's lots of that in there that we could maybe think is probably more like later Christian writers putting certain things ideas in like on these stories that maybe weren't necessarily true. But you have quite a strong Christian influence. You have from the year 1000 to the year 1500, it was sorry, Catholic. That was the Catholic period in Iceland. And then you have the Lutheran period after that until, I mean, Lutheranism is still the official, well, one of the official religions of Iceland now. But you have this time post-Catholicism where like a lot of the Catholic stuff was very demonized. And so you have a lot of these stories of Catholic priests who, you know, maybe were good people in their day, but later they were demonized into these sort of wizard priests. Some of it is probably true that they weren't maybe the nicest people, but a lot of it comes from this idea of the Christians and the Catholics specifically, like putting like a lot of stuff in grimoires and spells, writing a lot of these black books, that sort of thing, which like, you know, maybe like may or may not have been actually the case. Is that making sense?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Cool. So the Christians, like Catholic priests, were then yeah, very demonized, and maybe a lot of what they did do was you know not it's not they're not evil. It's just later the Lutherans had to convince people to become Lutheran and drop Catholicism. So they demonized a lot of these priests into being trollish figures as well. You have Grimmi Gottskalk, He was supposedly the author of Vreudscanner, like the Red Skin. It's one of these grimoires that's never been found, but it's spoken about a lot.
All right,
You
okay.
have this idea, you have this idea later that a lot of the Catholic priests were going to these black schools in Europe, supposedly that were like run by the devil or run by trolls, which is
Classic.
really
Okay, yeah,
interesting. So,
classic
right,
story here. Yeah.
it's really interesting because quite a lot of it mirrors quite a lot of Hungarian and Romanian, like random bits of Hungarian and Romanian folklore that I found out later, which is really interesting because there's like no connection at all other than these elements of these stories, which makes me think that maybe it's a later idea. But you do have these priests creating staves and making note as well of the symbols that a lot of the local people were using. And in the Catholic period, this was quite a prominent thing because Catholicism loves symbols. And you have lots of there are lots of staves that are used to invoke Jesus or to call on God or the Holy Spirit, stuff like this, that have like very like cruciform forms, like symbols. But then you have like a lot of rune stuff and like lots of symbols that maybe come from these runic alphabets that were later added and later used probably to make various other staves. So it's a really weird sort of it's a weird time period where you have like the Christian priests who were supposed to be like very devout, doing stuff the right way, probably actually making a bunch of these symbols themselves. Because we have so Agrippa's Three Books of Occult Philosophy was noted as being one of the books in the library at Skalholt, like in the catalogues, which
Yes,
is super interesting
fascinating.
because
Yeah.
like everywhere else in Europe, this was like massively demonized.
For sure. And they just had it in their library, which is, yeah.
Which is really cool because then you have like a bunch of planetary symbols that if you know the planetary symbols, you can sort of see them in a lot of grimoires. And lots of later grimoires also make note of angelic symbols as well. So you had all this information that was coming from the continent that like on the continent was like very demonized. But in Iceland, maybe it was just like, oh yeah, this is just more info on this stuff from these guys like way away. So it was looked at quite differently. And also, yeah, sorry, just on the subject of men and priests. You have in Iceland, especially the witch trials. It was mostly men that were tried and executed as well. I think there were only two women, I think, that were executed for witchcraft in Iceland,
Interesting.
and the rest were men. And also because this idea of symbols and staves and Galdur, it's very heavily gendered, so it was like they were doing their men's magic, whereas a lot of the fortune telling wasn't demonized here in the same way that it was in, or yeah, it wasn't seen as evil in the same way that it was on the continent because it has such a long cultural heritage. Fortune telling has been a thing here forever. And so, because that was like a sort of more like socially accepted and probably like safer practice, it wasn't seen as evil in the way that certain staves were, because you have various staves from these manuscripts that are used to do like really horrible stuff. So, I think that's probably that's it all ties in together, I'm sure.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm curious, what kind of divinatory practices are common there for the fortune telling stuff and all of that?
So tarot made its way here, and that's been quite a thing. Astrology as well has been around for quite a while. There's my favorite is the bone, the sheep knuckle bones, the like Valspar. So you have what were also used as so these sorry these bones they that is the knuckle bone from a sheep. They were also used as like quite commonplace like children's toys, which sounds really morbid. But a lot of bones and stuff were used. So people would carve
I used to
various
play
animals
with
and stuff
bones as
out
a
of
kid.
bones.
I don't
I think it's really cool because you had like these. It was very commonplace for bones to be around. You had people had their sheep and like some cattle and stuff and horses as well. They would keep the bones for to carve them into various things like little pendants and stuff like that. But then also we have loads of children's toys that were carved bone. And so this bone it probably was quite a common whole like common household item. And there's even like sets of kids' toys, I think up until like early 1900s that like parents would give their kids a set of bones, and the bones would represent like here's this one's a horse, this one's a farmer, this one's a sheep. Go and play farm animals with these bones, which sounds really creepy, but
Well, you use
was
what
very
you
normal. And so then you have the knuckle bone divination was really common, and there's even like a chant that you say, and you talk to the bone, and you say, okay, answer my questions. I'll give you gold and silver if you answer my questions, and I'll treat you right. But if not, I'm going to throw you in the fire. It's very there's quite a lot of very threatening things in Icelandic folk magic, which is really interesting, because you have like in lots of things that were influenced by Christianity, you have these like prayers and chants and stuff to Jesus and to other people, essentially saying like, okay, demon, leave and get out, or I'll set Jesus on you. So it's fun, but yeah, this knuckle bone, it's also really easy, because it has so one side there's like a rounded lump on it, and the other side there's a small indent, so you have a very obvious yes and no answer, with the rounded top is the yes and the indent is a no. So you ask these bones yes or no questions. You're supposed to say this chant, you roll the bone and ask various questions, and you get a very, very black and white answer, which I love, because I like the tarot, but I feel like, especially if you're just learning tarot, it's so much, and there's like so many ways that all these things could be interpreted. So with these bones, it's just like very simple yes and no.
Yeah, I
Yeah, and
love
so
that.
that's I think that's my favorite. Yeah, I think that's my favorite divination. Because later, like tea leaf reading was quite a big thing here as well, a bit later on. But then that's moving into more sort of closer to now.
So I have another Praxis question here with these bones. Like, you're promising to give them gold and silver, you're threatening to throw them in the fire. Do you anything? Is there like offerings that one makes to them, or punishments that one does if they don't cooperate, or something like that?
I'm not sure. I mean, I haven't had the need to throw them in the fire
Okay.
yet.
Yeah, all
But
right.
I think also it's I think maybe it comes from this thing of like, these were very commonplace items. So it's like, if you could make this threat, and if the bones didn't help you, you could throw them into the fire, because there's another one lying around that you could
That
use
makes
instead.
sense. Okay.
Um,
Sort of
so
like
I think
recruiting.
it
Who's going
comes
to
from
help me with
that.
this? Yeah, okay. I'd like it. Okay. Very cool. So, the practice of sitting out, I'm hoping we can talk a little bit about what this is and what it looks like.
Yeah, so we just have a love, because it's so simple. Quite a lot of Icelandic folk magic is very simple. There's a lot of stuff that doesn't require like many tools, or even like particular times and stuff. It doesn't often require that. So Uðursetur is a really good example of that, because all you need to do is just literally go and sit somewhere. And so if you want to, if you have maybe some, because it's more you ask some questions to the spirits, and you just sit and wait to receive the answer. So you can sort of like personalize, like specialize it a little bit by sitting in a place that's maybe more relevant to the question, or has some sort of connection to the virtues of whatever is relevant to the question. So if you maybe if you needed an answer about something related to a family question, you could go and sit in a graveyard that some of your family are buried in. Might be a bit spooky for people to begin with that, if they're not used to sitting in graveyards, especially at night. But to have to sit in a place that's relevant to the spirits, like if sit in a place where the spirits are relevant to the question that you're asking, or if you're doing it for divination, because you can just do it just to connect. But you can really specialize it. So if there's some dispute on the land, in the old days, and you were trying to work out like who was right, you could go and sit in between. If it was two neighboring farmers having an argument, you could go and sit in between their land, so sit like on their property line, call out to the spirits there, and say like, very mundane, very simple method of literally just speaking, sitting in a place and speaking out, hello, please come to me, I need your help, I have these questions and I need these answers. And so then you just sit, and typically you'll sit for quite a long time. The more sort of solid your practice in this becomes, the less time I've found you need to sit out. But it also can just be that you're sitting and waiting for a spirit to show up, and if that spirit is not working on a very rigid human time scale, then you're going to be sat there for quite a while. But yeah, it's a really, really simple practice. That's why I love it, because you can just sit anywhere and ask the spirits for answers. So you can use it as divination. But you can also, I would say, it's not strictly divination, because you can also just go and sit in a place, speak out to the spirits in this place, and say like, oh yeah, I want to start a dialogue with you, I want to communicate with you, I've just moved here, I want to deepen my connection to this place, can you show me something, or tell me something that will help me in a way that is honorable to you, and in a way that is for the greater good of this place. I found that just really speaking very simply and clearly about what you want is often quite well received. And then just waiting for a response, and if something pops into your mind, oh, what is it, like the personal bias of it's a bit the thing of learning to work out what are your thoughts, and what are things that have popped into your head that may be influences from spirits and things like that, which obviously takes quite a while to do. But when you've got the hang of that, you can use this really simple technique to communicate with all the spirits around you, and to to really deepen relationships with places, as well as to just ask specific questions. If there's, I mean, farms is the main example from Iceland because that's really all there is. But if you had if you had a question about farming or about your land, you could sit on your land and ask the spirits, "Hey, I need an answer to this question. Please help me work this out." And sit there. And I've heard from, I mean, from so many people who I know who use this practice. Sometimes you're sat there and you get this really overwhelming feeling of sort of melting back into the earth and becoming very, like, quite suddenly very attuned with this place, and getting these very quick, very quick, if you're lucky, phrases and words that come into your head, or images, various other things. When you're, it's sort of the skill of divination that's very, very wide and, like, open-ended. The more you do that sort of thing, the more you learn to recognize what's coming to you. But it's a really useful practice to really connect with the land and to ask spirits of different places what they want, essentially, and to it's a really animistic way as well for me to connect with the spirits and to learn what they want and to learn how we can live in harmony, really. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, these really kind of simple practices can have a lot of power in them. And what you're saying makes a lot of sense. So I want to talk more about Jesus, but first, how do you feel about taking a bibliomancy break?
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, fantastic. Greetings, it's me, Alexa from the future. I hope you're enjoying the episode so far. Man, I love the idea of a fabled grimoire that has yet to be found. Classic trope, and I am here for it. We're going to be getting into that bibliomancy break in just a little while here, as well as hearing lots more cool stuff from Albert Scheel. But now it is time to get into the episode within the episode. My next guest, Omega, has anonymously published a book about alchemy called Fables and Chimeras, which you can find links to in the show notes. We talk about the intersections he's found between his work with Santa Muerte and some classical ideas in alchemy, and much more, including nonviolent communication. It's a really interesting conversation that I'm stoked to share with you all. Omega's bio is as follows: Omega Dekay is an artist, author, philosopher, nonviolent communication speaker, and devotee of La Santissima Muerte, focusing on holistic, dark, and hermetic themes in his work. He attempts to unearth a unique interpretation of the world using alchemical imagery to both enlighten and confuse the audience, leading to an accurate portrayal of reality. He's written a book, Fables and Chimeras, by Anonymous, of aphorisms and personal reflections pertaining to 50 alchemical texts from around the 15th and 16th century, and expresses many valuable insights into both operative and philosophical fields of alchemy. Fuck yeah. I'll be back later to share some updates about the Green Mushroom Hyphosigil Project, an ongoing magical orking and working group that I and others have been cultivating for the last 3.5 years or so now, as well as about some upcoming hybrid Hecatean new moon protection magic I'm organizing that you can be part of should it strike your fancy. We'll also be hearing listener mail and shoutouts and more. But now let's get into alchemy, Santa Muerte, Fables and Chimeras, and more with Omega Decay. All right, well, my guest today is Omega. Omega, how's it going?
Hey, how's it going? Good. I'm good. Good to be here.
Oh, yeah, well, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm excited to hear about what you've got going on and everything. To get us rolling into it here, would you mind telling me and the listeners a little bit about yourself and what you've got going on with your magical work and all that good stuff?
Sure thing. First of all, I'd like to let people know that I'm a scholarly failure. I was a failure in high school and I didn't go to college, and so I wanted to point that out because a lot of the guests you've had on have their credits, and so, but what I've dedicated myself to this past decade was to three things in my life, main in my life, that I wanted to share with the occult community. And that has been La Santísima Muerte, nonviolent communication, and alchemy, which is what I'm have some notes written down here to share with you all today.
All right on. Well, yeah, I was excited to hear that you wanted to talk about these topics because I think that this is going to be a really cool conversation. And Santa Muerte has actually sort of been hitting me up recently. She's popping up every once in a while in my life and kind of saying hi. And so I'm excited to be welcoming her to the show as well.
Yeah, I'm into that. Bless La Santa Muerte. I consider myself a devotee of hers. And, I noticed that there, in my studies of alchemy and in studying La Santa Muerte, what stood out to me the most are two things. First of all, that there is a rule of silence. Every time I talk to a devotee from Mexico, and they're just normal, regular people like you and me. What I've noticed is that they remain quiet when I ask them about La Santísima Muerte. They tell me a couple of things, but after that, they all get this silence about them, and that intrigued me. They'll tell me something, well, she represents everything that's cold, and she represents justice. But after that, nothing. And the other thing that stood out to me about her was that she is recognized as owner of the secrets of the world. And I thought, wow, when I heard that, she's the owner of the secrets of the world. And so it reminded me again of alchemy, of how there are secrets to the universe, to reality, and to the everyday world that we live in. Another thing I want to say about La Santa Muerte is that she is the balance to where everything returns to. And I can imagine rivers, streams, all returning back to the sea, to the heart of the water. And that's why I tell myself that that's why people often picture her by the beach. We can get this really deep symbolism from it. I've also noticed that there are a lot of idiosyncrasies to her. There's many, she's not part of any specific culture, even though her birthplace was in Mexico. She's across all natures, and usually on her statues, you can see parts of different cultures embedded as part of talismans. And I got that from, I got that specific realization when I was watching an interview by Orly Stewart on La Santísima Muerte. She is primarily, there's a secrecy about her that you have to maintain, and that she's the owner of the secrets of the world. And I'm wondering what comes up for you, Lux, when you hear that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I noticed that when we spoke before, there seemed to be a couple of intersections in some of the things that we thought about in our practices in terms of like your work with Santa Muerte and my work with Hecate. And I almost wonder if they might be sort of, if Hecate is like my mother in this sort of context, the mother of wishes or whatever, then perhaps Santa Muerte is like a distant auntie that is like friends with her or something like that was the sort of sense that I get about it. But who knows, right? I'm sure it's different for everybody when they consider these relationships and how they contextualize it within their own work and lives and everything. But I really enjoyed hearing about some of the symbolism, the memento mori stuff and everything, the idea of the scales and the owl and everything like that. I thought that was really powerful.
Yeah, she definitely employs a lot of these symbolisms that are present in alchemy, like the owl and the hourglass, and even the scythe, the lantern. These are things that when I think about, I get chills running down my spine because there's so many of them, and they all have this very specific alchemical meaning to them, like the owl representing salt or things of that nature. But this with La Santa Muerte, it's conflicting, it's conflicting to see people being very hush hush about it and then wanting to be a person who wants to reveal these things to the open world. And so there is something almost political about it that is exciting and interesting to think about it, because we have to be open-minded about these things and see if there might be something we're missing. Even though I'm very very for non-gatekeeping, I want to bring alchemy and I want to bring all these things to the open world. And I kind of lost my track a little bit, so maybe we can move on to our next topic,
Well,
or
I just want to ask you just real quick, because I do think that there is something interesting there that you're getting at, like this idea of, wanting to have this, like, openness and stuff. And from what I understand, there is some misconception surrounding, working with Santo Marte. There's some, people that say that it's a closed practice, meaning that, you have to be sort of initiated into it by a person that was, part of it, and they themselves were initiated and all the rest of it. But then I've also heard that that's definitely not the case, and that, she'll work with whoever will work with her, because death comes to everybody, and there's a sort of universality that she brings with being this goddess of death. And so there is this kind of openness and universality that exists, but then there's also this secrecy. And so there's an interesting tension there that exists.
yeah, thank you for sharing that. There definitely is, and I can't wait to find out about a different perspective so I can take it into consideration. I guess it's part of the natural process of wanting to be conscious and aware, to be in conflict with these things that are maybe going to be answered sometime in the future when we're not alive anymore.
Well, maybe moving to alchemy too, we can kind of think about the way that forces play together and mix. And, there is always sort of a tension that exists, and that tension is sort of like a stored potential or something like that that can be released sometimes for magical purposes too.
Yeah, I mean that's really deep what you just said, and I'm reminded of the burning of Notre Dame, how the church in Paris burned down, and there was a picture of an alchemist. As you know, the Church of Notre Dame is very known for alchemical meanings. There's a whole book written about it by somebody called Fulcanelli. It's a very well-known work. And he talks about how the architecture and the emblems put on the church have a rich alchemical meaning. Anyway, there was a picture taken of an alchemist looking at the fire in sort of a desperation or wonder. It's a very complicated expression to his face, but that's what it reminds me of.
Yeah, I have chills. That is wild.
Okay, so let's move on to nonviolent communication, and this is something that relates to the magical community because there's a sense of feeling life force in nonviolent communication, which
Maybe
are
we
all.
should define, maybe before we go into nonviolent communication, we could just give a quick definition of, like, what does that phrase mean?
Yeah, well, I have something written down here. Nonviolent communication is a system, a language that promotes natural compassion in people by focusing on needs as human beings rather than what is considered morally right or wrong. Our human needs are those experiences we all seek and long for as human beings: safety, connection, understanding, liberty, meaning, among others. The idea of nonviolent communication assumes that thinking based around someone being good or bad separates us from compassion and using reasonable thinking to figure out our lives. It assumes that our language and mentality is set up in a way that promotes violence and confusion. Concepts like anger, hatred, shame, and guilt are the emotions felt when there is a separation from life. And in NVC, they are seen as alarm systems for such. They are a product of morality, judgment, since it originates from thinking something should not be a certain way. And I want to pause there.
Thank you.
Right. So, nonviolent communication is a completely different psychology than what we're used to. Instead of, asking for saying that I need a car, in NVC, you would say, I have a need for transportation that I'm trying to meet. So you can kind of see with that when we make requests, it's a completely different world. When we're in a relationship, instead of saying, I need you to take out the trash, you would reference it as, I have a need for order in the house, and I would like for you to help me meet that need. So there's a way, there's a cooperation here that takes place.
I really like this in terms of formulating statements of intent. Like, there's this idea that when you're writing out a statement of intent for a ritual or ceremony or sigil or whatever it is, you don't want to be too specific because you're cutting off avenues of possibility from yourself by doing that. Like, it's a lot easier to get a car of any color than a car that's bright purple or something like that, right? So if it's just a car that you need or transportation that you need, actually sort of identifying that and focusing on that is a beneficial thing to do. So I love taking that into consideration in this context as well.
Right. When we make a manifestation to have something in our lives, which might be a romantic partner or a car, for example, we can ask for these things. But what nonviolent communication is trying to say is at the end of the day, everything we do is in service of feelings and needs. So it's really the need for transportation or for safety that you're trying to meet through a car. And so it might be a good idea to really focus in on what's important, which is feelings and needs, and the felt life force of emotions and virtues, which are needs, should be of interest to any serious energy worker if they want to attempt to manifest for something. So
Yeah, right on.
I want to say that it's not a bad thing to want to manifest for a specific house or a specific job. But it's really what's really going on in the manifestation is moving the channeling of feelings and needs by naming them. And that's a little bit into my take on manifestation.
All right, fuck yeah.
I see nonviolent communication as a kind of game, of making life more wonderful. And so I'm just going to read through these notes here because I think they're important. NVC changes the way we make requests to doable actions based on needs being met and can change the way we manifest our future. That's what I wanted to say.
Right on.
What are your personal experiences with nonviolent communication?
Well, I think that it's complicated. I think that some of the really effective communicators that I've, talked to definitely are sort of in this territory. Also, people who are especially good at, like, managing people. Like, the good bosses that I've had, I think they do sort of look at people as humans first and kind of treat people like addressing people's human needs rather than, we need this right now or whatever the thing might be, starting from square one in terms of like, okay, we're all humans here. We're all in the same boat. How can we kind of like come together with that reality and confront the situation from the boots on the ground scenario we find ourselves in rather than this kind of fantasy of how we wish things would or should be, I think can be a really effective way of approaching life in general. I wish that there were more interactions based in this way in my life, I think I would say.
Yeah, me too. It's very easy to get things done when our mentality is built around what you should do because of debt or because of duty. But it's another thing to make a decision based on feelings and needs. And what I've noticed is that nonviolent communication isn't very good at getting things done quick, but it takes a long time to make decisions. And that's the thing we don't have in today's world is time. So you
Yeah.
can see how this could be difficult for any person, living a day-to-day job, paying rent, and this sort of thing. So I have sympathy for that, and I'd like to think empathy as well.
Yeah, totally. So I'm curious if you've been able to apply the techniques or the thinking of nonviolent communication to some of your online interactions and how that's gone for you.
Well, it's I mean I've had some friendships that I've never had before, even in real life, because of nonviolent communication. It's very easy to find somebody on your level who also speaks nonviolent communication. So I've had friendships that felt like we were dating, but the platonic friendship was always emphasized. But in spite of that, I still felt like when I would finish talking to this person over the phone, I felt over the moon, like I could achieve anything in life. You know, we all feel that when we fall in love with someone, but this was a friendship, and I was still writing poetry about them.
That's
So
fucking
you can,
awesome. Yeah, fuck yeah.
yeah.
And I think that, like, especially for some people are especially sort of like conditioned or, you know, taught by society that like you're not allowed to like have emotional connections with anybody other than like the person you're dating or anything like that. And in other parts of the world, it's not the case and stuff. And it doesn't need to be the case for us here, right? I think that there's a lot of sadness and loneliness that comes as a result of it, but it doesn't need to be the case. So I'm happy to hear that you've been able to find those types of connections. That's fucking awesome.
Yeah, it's only made my connection stronger, but also more complicated because
Sure.
there's a lot of things that I don't have words for. I mean, love, for example, we have words like profound happiness or fuzzy warm feelings, but those words don't actually come close to the actual experience of this platonic love, you know.
Yeah.
And it goes, I think this goes into the conversation about alchemy because there's a book and a blog I'd like to share before I start talking about it because I've heard a lot of references to it in other alchemy podcasts, and so I wanted to shout them out. Blog is called nemocap.wordpress, nemocap.wordpress, and the book is by that same person is published on Lulu, and it's called Philalethes Revealed by Captain Nemo and Frater Zerkoni. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but there's been a lot of podcasts where they reference him, but no one seems to give him credit. So there you go.
Okay, well, right on.
So, you know, talking about alchemy, I think that alchemy is a kind of fairy tale for the young at heart or for the old soul, depending on your perspective. So, you know, sometimes we have words for somebody that seems different than the rest. They either call them young at heart or they call them an old soul. And I always thought that they were the same thing. But I think that alchemy is a kind of fairy tale for not for young children, but for people who are young at heart, I mean. But the fascinating part about it is, what if it's not? What if it's the other way around? And we're actually waking, you have to wake somebody up from the fairy tale that alchemy is in fact real. Instead of telling somebody that Santa Claus isn't real, you're actually telling them, well, alchemy actually is real. And that's a daydream that I had that I wanted to share on your show because alchemy is a sacred concept, you know? It's not something that you should just talk about lightly. It's like Catholicism or any other religion, there needs to be some level of respect to it. And I want to take alchemy seriously because it's a real practice where the alchemist pours their heart and soul into the formation of the universe in the flask. This isn't science. This isn't about finding out the specific weight of something, the specific principles of gravity or what have you. I'm not a student at all. I failed science, but I know that science tries to obtain a profit from nature, something that can be profitable. And even in things like quantum mechanics, quantum physics, these are things that are specific. Even things like the universal Higgs boson, these things don't compare to the creation of the universe. And that's what the alchemist is seriously trying to encounter.
All
And
right. Fuck
yeah,
yeah.
you know, and a lot of people might have a problem with that, I'm sure, because it sounds like I'm talking bad about science, but what I'm trying to say is that they are two very different schools of thought.
Sure, I agree. I think that there's places, especially in history, where they dance with each other and stuff, but they're definitely completely different approaches, and they're, yeah, definitely not the same thing. I agree with you.
Because the work is a great work. It's the great work of all of existence, of even other worlds. So it's the range and the scope is very different from science to the point where it's like two completely different things.
Yeah, I agree. So my background is in science, so I'm sort of like I'm a huge nerd for this stuff. And I think that for me, like science, it's important to remember that it's not really supposed to be like a dot, like a body of knowledge, like a corpus of knowledge. It's supposed to be a method, right? Like there's a method for interrogating the world around us that we can use to try to approximate truth. Like we can't ever necessarily come to it, but we can, form these approximations of what's going on around us and build these models and work from there. And that's kind of all it's about. And I think, unfortunately, in modern life, it's kind of taken a spot psychologically that used to be occupied by a lot of like religious structures and stuff. And that's caused a little bit of well, not a lot of tension and confusion and all kinds of things in our world. But yeah, and I think that there's a place for all of these different approaches, and it's also a good idea to know which approach you're using and to not, get confused about which tool does what or whatever. So yeah, I totally agree with you.
Exactly. And let's emphasize what you just said. Science is a method of knowledge and a method, and alchemy is a body of knowledge. I want to point that out, that alchemy isn't a method, it's a body of work. And so that's a really rad distinction you just made. I want to point that out to everyone.
Sure. And I think that alchemy can also be an approach as well, kind of like science. Like, I think that, well, everybody might have a different way of thinking about it. But when I think about it, I sort of think about it as a way of trying to sort of peek behind the curtains of our reality in terms of like what's actually going on and how things fit together. And yeah, how are those processes, mirrored in other places? Like, there's this interesting fractal nature to the reality in which we live that's endlessly fascinating to investigate and everything. So yeah, I think that, like, maybe for the modern alchemist, there's a lot of places where they are sort of applying that more esoteric level of thinking about things to modern scientific concepts as well.
Yeah, absolutely. The alchemist aims to perform a service under the laws of nature inside what is called the macrocosm, under the authority of nature. And I thought that was so profound because that's exactly it. It seems almost like you get everything that you see in nature, and then you pour all that knowledge into the flask.
Yeah, I love
And
that.
to me, that's a very meaningful connection between the mind of the alchemist and the subject, the substance, because it's trying to pretty much imitating the mind of the alchemist based on his knowledge of nature.
Right on.
And I'd like to talk about the scientific method and in alchemy. And to me, it seems strange how so much time has passed since the books of Falconelli, or books like the Book of Aquarius, where they tried to scientifically penetrate the alchemical corpus. And I've always wondered, why doesn't somebody attempt to do this stuff? I've read about 50, more than 50 books in the last 10 years, and I can see that there is a method that I can recreate. So if I can do it, why hasn't anybody stepped up and decided to experiment on water, water and salt, asphalt, oil, which is ancient photosynthesis? There should be somebody who makes a GoFundMe to start a laboratory and a storage unit or something.
I love this idea. Have you ever encountered the work of Brian Cotnor?
Brian Cardinal, no, I haven't.
You might want to check his stuff out. He's got some great stuff on alchemy, both like historical and some modern thoughts and stuff. I took a class with him once. He's a very cool guy too. So yeah, it might be worth it to give his stuff a look as well. And for people listening that are, interested in this topic. You had mentioned when we first began that you don't feel like you're a scholar. You don't feel like, you told me you're like, I failed at school, right? And I appreciate that you're, willing to share about your practice and stuff. coming from that perspective, because I think it's important for people to remember that, what is done in a magical practice is something that's accessible to anybody, regardless of what kind of educational or other resources might be available to you. And I'm hoping you wouldn't mind for people that are listening that might be in a sort of similar position, kind of giving some thoughts or suggestions about ways of pursuing this work that are accessible.
Well, the thing is, you have to be lucky, and you have to pray, do meditate, do everything you can to get luck on your side, because most of the books that I encountered was just by searching online and reading books and just clicking on random things. That's how I found out about it. But there's another thing I want to share. And that is that the connections that I've made with people, where they would show me things, show me book recommendations, were based on respect and honor. And if I didn't have those two things, if I didn't show myself to be a person who's worthy of respect, then I wouldn't be able to talk to them. So that's my advice for anybody, that to do magic, pray, do whatever you can so that some higher power, some spirit can help, and also employ honor and respect in your everyday life. Be an honest person.
Fuck yeah, thank you so much, Omega. I really appreciate you being willing to like share those thoughts and everything, and for reaching out today. Is there anything that you would like to talk about that we haven't covered yet?
Yeah, I have a book that I've
Oh shit.
authored where I read about 50 alchemical books and poured all my knowledge into it. And if you are somebody who's well acquainted with alchemy, there's something in there for you and on every page. And the book is called Fables and Chimeras by Anonymous. It's on Amazon, and you can buy it now.
Okay, right on. So, Fables and Chimeras. Can you tell me a little bit about the title?
Fables and Chimeras is saying that alchemy is like a fairy tale. It's full of things that you can get lost in. And alchemy, if you believe in certainty too much, if you're too obsessed with forming a model of the world, then you'll get lost. And that's why it's called Fables and Chimeras, because most of us are very hungry, so to speak, for certainty. We want to be certain of the world, and we want to know how it works. But in alchemy, you'll get lost. You have to focus on the wondrous, the marvelous, and be happy, be content with that, with just observing the fables and chimeras as they are, and not to build a model of the world. And I'd like to read the back page if I can before I
Sure,
leave.
yeah, please.
The philosopher hears a call from the gods to meet Lady Alchemy in order for her to answer the questions of life and death. Traveling along the ancient natural path, far away from civilization, the initiate is confronted with bewildering chimeras that reveal the world as an interconnected reality, leading to an immersion into the mysteries. So that talks a little more about why I chose to call it Fables and Chimeras.
Right on, I love it. Very cool. So when you first began writing this book, where did that research kind of start? Like when were you in the process of like, I love alchemy, I want to like learn about alchemy? When did that turn into I want to write a book about alchemy?
It started when I was highlighting. What I did was I compiled an entire book of 50 alchemical texts from the 1500, and around that age, around that year, 1400, 1500, 1600. And I noticed that there was something that had so many highlighted, so many notes in this book, that I could write a book about it. And what would happen if I did it? And I thought, nobody has ever written down these things on paper, so I thought that I would be the first one to do it. Well, that's the kind of energy that I came with it. This isn't something. I've read a lot of alchemy books, and so I know kind of what's out there, and I wanted to do something new.
Right on. So, if somebody listening is kind of curious about beginning a practice with alchemy or maybe working with Santa Muerte, What would you advise for people such as that? I know that these situations are different, so there's probably going to be two different answers there, but
Yeah.
I'm curious what your advice would be.
Well, the advice is very similar because, being a devotee of La Santa Muerte is something very special and very holy. It's something where nature becomes aware of your existence. And I know that can be done through almost any magical, it could be done with any magical or religious endeavor. But when I personally became a devotee of La Santa Muerte and I had my statue and her altar, yeah, I felt like something came into my life, something that kept me curious when otherwise I would be impatient. It kept me open when I thought that I was in deep depression. It kept me curious. It kept me curious, pondering why the sky is blue and why the grass is green, so to speak. And through that contemplation, I arrived at things about the world that I didn't know before, like things about alchemy. I would have visions about the trees being blind and mute, about how the animals don't speak for a reason. A lot of beautiful things started to happen to my life. So my advice is to treat it like something very special and dear to your heart.
Okay, I love that. Well, thank you so much for sharing your thoughts and about your practice and everything today. Where can listeners find your work?
You can find my book on Amazon. That's pretty much all I have. And I also have, I'm also a filmmaker and an artist. I have short films that have to do with alchemy, and
Okay.
it's called Outbreak Live on
Okay,
YouTube.
cool.
So be
Maybe you could
sure.
share a link with me and I could put that in the show notes too for people if they want to check it out.
Sure thing. Okay.
Okay,
Yeah.
rad.
So before we leave, I want to extend my appreciation to you and to say that I don't know if you're gonna put this on the show, but you meet my need for competence, Lux. Your conversation is always very, you're really attuned to what I'm trying to say and share here. So thank you for being a clear channel.
Thank you. Thank you so much for saying. I appreciate it. Fuck yeah. Thanks so much to Omega Decay for joining me. I really appreciate what he had to say about nonviolent communication and so much more. I really love hearing about other people's approach to deity work too, since that's been such a meaningful part of my life and my current magical paradigm and everything. More on the Hecatean protection ritual I'll be planning later. Definitely check out the show notes for links to Fables and Chimeras and Omega's other stuff. He said something really interesting about the idea of the effects of magic being the result of naming feelings and needs and stuff, and I think that there's some really interesting, like, kind of deeper naming magic in there that I've been thinking about lately. And yeah, something I still have yet to unpack, but there's some interesting tethers there, perhaps, as my friend Keats Ross might call them. It's also a sort of little extra tidbit I wanted to share with you all here as well. Both Albert and Omega mentioned luck being an important component in their own magical journeys, which is definitely something that I can relate to, and which has been another thread that kind of ties these conversations together for me. The topic of luck recently came up on the Discord server where we organize stuff for the Mushroom Project, the Green Machine. I thought I would share something that I offered there here as well. Okay, so I wrote, "Here's a luck spell I made up when I was a kid. Take a penny that you found on the ground face up and paint the tail side of it green. I used to mix my spit with the paint, but go with whatever makes sense to you to link it to you. Do something to make the penny fun, like something that would match the resonance or feeling you get when you have great luck, that feeling of excitement or relief or like wonder or whatever. I remember decorating the side that I used to paint with something that I could do to do this, but now that I'm older, I can think of a bunch of different ways that that could look or go. Different material, perhaps, that you could use, or all kinds of other things. Carry it with you as a luck charm. It's simple, but it's worked great for me in the past. I love super simple shit like that. At the time that I wrote this, I hadn't thought about it in years and really wanted to make one of them, so I did. And I remembered when I wrote this post that so much of the magic that I did at some points in my life involved coins. And this actually is something that comes up for me still in terms of like finding them on the ground when I go on my meditative walks, and this being a sort of like indication of things sometimes, whatever a coincidence that I choose to define as meaningful, however you want to like look at it. But yeah, it's something that comes up for me and everything. Coin is, of course, a symbol of manifestation and some contextualizations of it, but of course, currency is another thing. You know, it's currency is a sort of agreement that is made. There's stuff about consent that comes up there as well. And so, yeah, I'm curious to hear what your thoughts about the coin as a symbol, both magically or perhaps practically, are for you. Of course, wealth and things like that, but I'm sure there's all kinds of things like that. You can write to me at luxoccultpod@gmail.com or get me on Instagram at luxoccultpod with your coin thoughts. All right, we're going to be getting into that bibliomancy break with Albert Scheel and hearing all kinds of more cool stuff about Icelandic folk magic and how that works with the planets and other things. I will be back after the interview to do listener mail and shoutouts, give you updates and other tidbits and whatnot. But now, without further ado, let's hear the rest of that chat with Albert Scheel. So the way this works is I will have you ask a question, and then I will roll some dice, and we'll figure out what book we'll be consulting, and then I will perform the divination for you.
Oh, I don't know if I should be really selfish and ask, like, I don't know if I should ask how my book will be received, if that's really selfish.
I don't know. I feel like it's okay to be selfish in your own magical practice sometimes, right?
Yeah.
I mean, where else will you do it?
That's very true.
Yes.
Ooh.
Although I do call on Eris, so that might, you know, flavor
Okay.
the question that you'll
Yeah.
ask. So she rarely disappoints, though.
I wonder, do you think something like is the general witchcraft, general like modern witchcraft movement moving more towards animism? Would that make sense as a question for this?
Sure. Yeah, this is actually a
Nice.
trend that a few people have asked me about recently, and so I love the idea of asking the Oracle. Oh,
Nice.
Eris, do you think that modern witchcraft is, and occultism as well, is really kind of moving in a more animistic direction? Okay, let's see. We're going to be looking at Howl and Other Poems by Allen Ginsberg. Let me grab it. Complicated classic here. Oh, Eris, do you think that modern witchcraft and occultism is moving more in an animistic direction? The Lord's Prayer. I have mystical visions and cosmic vibrations. America, I still haven't told you what you did to Uncle Max after he came home from Russia. Okay. Thank you, Eris. Mystical visions and cosmic vibrations. Well, I'm going to have to puzzle this one out a little bit more. Sometimes these answers seem a lot more clear the second time I hear them when I'm doing my production for the podcast. But
Nice.
I would have to say that if anybody asked me, I have noticed a trend towards that myself recently. Is that something that you have noticed as well?
Think so. I mean, so I'm running a course actually at the moment in animism and helping people connect with the spirits of their place and build a really like land-based thing, like thing land-based practice and maybe not necessarily tradition, but just a land-based view of how they practice. And I think like I don't know, for me it's like this idea sort of popped into my head like quite well recently. I started planning this in January, but like late last year, I would say this popped into my head of like, okay, I know how I do things. I know how I break the world around me down into various different boxes that I can that if I did this with other people, maybe it would help them learn about their land. So I think for me, it's like I got a really sort of sudden like inspiration to put this course together, and I was like, okay, I know what I would like people to get out of it at the end. I'm going to now work backwards to work out how they can get there. And it came to me like very quickly and very sort of out of nowhere. So,
I love that. If people are listening and they're like, oh, I want to take this class, how can they find out more about it?
So it's already it's started for this year. So I'm going to do another one next year. But it's 13 months, so people get a whole cycle of the year and then one sort of like evaluation at the end. It's not one of those courses where it's like you'll get a certificate of passing or whatever. It's like,
I don't get a badge if I complete it. Just
I mean,
joking.
maybe I'll get some badges. That would actually be quite cool though, so maybe I'll do that. But yeah, the idea is just to help people build a build like a diary of their year that really focuses on the land around them and like looking at every single seasonal change, looking at the moons. One part of what I was doing and what I have done in my Sussex practice before I moved to Iceland as well, quite a few years ago now, was to name the moons of the month after like things that were happening in my landscape, because you have, at least to like grow up in England, you have like some, I think, some older like English names for different moons, but none of them were like massively relevant to where I was. So I was looking at like, oh, okay, the birds go at this year, so this is this moon around this moon, so this is like the birds leaving moon. That's not what I called it, but I was like, that's the idea behind what the season of this moon will be about, and about like recognizing what animals are moving where, which also I find like animals moving in and out of a place really affects the spirit of that place as well. So that's just, yeah, that's one example. But the idea is just to help people work out like what plants are around them as well, and by looking at the plants and animals, how we can work out like what the spirits of these places might be, what the spirits of these places might like, what they might not like, how we can communicate with them, and how we can build relationships with them, so that we are very like super rooted in our land, within what, like 5 mile radius of wherever you live. That's the idea behind this course.
I
But I'll
like
start it
that.
again next year.
Okay.
get people involved again from. I wanted to start it in winter as well, because here it's like, now it's the first day of summer here. There's no spring or autumn in Iceland, just summer and winter. So that's been an interesting thing to translate that to.
Yeah.
Like, luckily I've lived in other places with four seasons, but here it's been quite interesting to translate like how that's viewed, and how it can also help people like slow down and take stock of everything, and move like slowly through the winter and then a little bit faster in summer, that sort of thing.
Very cool. Yeah, I love this. I think that, it's always important. Phil Hine talks about this a lot in his work. He's been a huge influence on me. But the idea of like really taking stock of a situation first before, taking any actions magically or otherwise, I think is really important. And having that like land-based practice where you really are doing literally just that of like really taking stock of the actual situation, I think it's really important and really powerful. So yeah, very cool. So I was hoping we could talk a little bit more about Jesus. I've spoken to people in the past who have felt like, oh, Christianity and magic, they just don't mix together, right? And of course, people that study magic will know much better that there's all these very rich traditions where Christianity is a part of it, and it of course kind of survives through Christianity in secret in a lot of contexts as well for looking at the grimoires and everything. And so I'm hoping we could talk a little bit about how Jesus shows up for people in their practices in Iceland, and if this is something that is like taboo, or if people are very open about it, or yeah, just curious to hear about what all that looks like.
There's the ending of quite a few spells is Iesusnapne, so like in Jesus's name, which is interesting because you have, from what I've seen, there are lots of spells and prayers, especially to remove ghosts and like, negative forces and things like that. There are a lot of those that end in Amen, but there are also a lot that end in Jesus's name, which is interesting because that's not something I've seen in lots of other places. But then you also have certain spells where, you'll call on, I call on God the Father, I call on Jesus, I call on Mary, Freya, Odin, Thor, Beelzebub, Satan, and da 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 da. And it's like there's some examples of spells that you're calling on absolutely everyone and everything, which I think is pretty unique. At least I haven't come across that elsewhere. So Jesus is in this weird little place as well, where like there's not, especially in like the Catholic period, Jesus would have been much more important. And there are certain protective staves as well that invoke Jesus and have Jesus as the name, Jesus's name in them. But it's also interesting that like Jesus was not, at least in the folk magic, Jesus is not like as big of a deal as in other places. Like I know there's quite a lot of specifically like Swedish folk magic where you'll be using a lot of scripture and reading various stories about Jesus, as like the verbal part of the spell work, which doesn't really come up in Iceland as much. So it's weird that like you have Jesus's name being invoked and certain symbols that are supposed to represent Jesus, but you don't have as many of the psalms and the gelt, like the verbal magic that is specifically about Jesus's life. So it's weird, because also then you have like not so much Jesus, but you have Mary occupying this space where she's very heavily syncretized with the goddess Freya. And I think there's even one instance. I need to remember the written source, but I have read it that there were, I think, in East Iceland in maybe the 13th, 14th century, there are examples of people praying to Mary to wreck the ships of their enemies and things like that. Which like that's very not like very much like not what you do in Catholicism.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, it almost reminds me of like praying to Persephone's Praxidise or something like that. Or like, yeah, that's fascinating.
It's really cool. But yeah, Jesus is interesting, because it's also like with the devil as well. These are known figures to all the people in Iceland. Of people knew who the devil was, people knew who Jesus was, but they aren't as like they aren't as mentioned or as sort of revered, at least in the spell work that we have here. It's not quite the same vibe. Like the fear in the devil was not as much, wasn't as big of a worry. It was more the worry of, oh, am I going to die in the winter this year? Or
Sure, that
like,
makes sense. Other
so,
more pressing things to worry about than the devil,
yeah.
perhaps.
Which it's also, yeah, I wonder if that's the thing as well of maybe that's why Jesus isn't so big, because you have all these spells and you have all of these staves as well to give like pretty immediate results. So you don't need to maybe pray to Jesus or God as much to fix these things for you, because the power. It tends to feel as though the people believe the power lay more in their own hands than it did in God or Jesus. I hope that's a. I'm not sure if like scholars would agree with me completely on that, but I feel like from a practical perspective, looking at it seems that that's a bit more of the vibe here.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, or at least you could say like people, rather than taking this maybe what you could consider like passive devotional practice of like, prayer, which I mean, I guess I don't love that I call it passive. I think that I'm not going to die on that hill, but moving past that, something like where you actually are creating and crafting an object or, making, a bind rune or sigil or whatever it is, that could be maybe more active since you are, as you said, using your hands to do it. Yeah, that makes sense. So I love the 12 Apostles healing charm that you mention in the book. Would you mind telling me a little bit about how this came to you and what that looks like?
Yeah, so the stave itself, there are staves. That's also the interesting thing, is that though there's not a huge, like Jesus is mentioned, but though Jesus isn't as big, there are so many staves that are attributed to King Solomon, to the 12 apostles, to angels, to loads of these other biblical characters. And so the 12 apostles charm, there's a stave for this. There's also mention of invoking the 12 apostles in healing work. And so it's a bit my own UPG, where I've taken, okay, here's the mention of this being a thing previously, but I can't find a specific example of this anymore. So I'll take the stave and I'll experiment with it, and I'll see if I work this stave with herbs, with words, with things like that. If I work it like a lot of this other Christian, like very heavily Christian healing magic from other places, if I work it in that sort of way, will it work? And I've worked it many times. I've had pretty good success with it. That's also the thing in this book where I'm like, I feel like I'm quite honest of like, hey, here's this. Like, this is the very old stuff. This is the newer stuff. Here's stuff that is my UPG based on these things. Please also try it out, because I can't say like, oh, this 100% does exactly what it says. I've had very, very good experiences with it, or I wouldn't have put it in the book. But that's one example where it's like, yeah, here's something that has a base in folklore and has a base in Christian myth and stuff as well. And also, yeah, just try it out. Like, I've worked it successfully. Try it out and see how it works. And it worked. That's the thing. At least it helped aid in healing of a couple of friends over the years. So.
Yeah, right on. Yeah, I think that some of the things I've found through my own, UPG or whatever that have hit the hardest for me, right? Like, and so I think that you're sharing that is really cool. Very cool. So I'm kind of curious, if people are new to approaching Icelandic folk magic or anything adjacent to it, are there any pitfalls that you might point out that people might want to avoid or anything like that?
Yeah, so I think like I would say a lot of what I'm so a lot of what I'm writing about in this book, I'm very clear where I'm like, this makes more sense to practice it in an animistic way within Iceland, the country, if you're living here, as well as like, yeah, this is very open and this is for, available for people to sort of tweak to where they are. But my main thing with it is that I would say like, it's not Viking stuff. Like I know a lot of people get quite hopeful when they hear about magic from Iceland that it's going to be like ancient Viking stuff, and I'm just like, sorry. Like a lot of what we know. I mean, even so, so Snorri's Edda, like from which most written Norse mythology comes from. This is written by a Christian priest who wanted to impress the kings of Norway. I don't necessarily think of it as the most massively accurate descriptions of these gods and forces and spirits. So I would say, like, go on that. Know that like a lot of what he wrote was to angle it in a way that made the kings of Norway feel like their claim to the throne, and supposedly as being descended from Odin, like was backed up by a lot of what he was writing. So I would say, like, don't get stuck on the Viking stuff, because a lot of the Viking stuff isn't even really Viking stuff. It's like l a lot later on
King
that.
fan fiction, if you will.
Well, essentially, yeah, like that's the thing, that it's quite a lot of it is it's just like, yeah, these guys did this thing. I would say things like Njáls saga and like some other sagas where it's written like at least a little bit closer to the time period, that's maybe a little bit more accurate, and we have examples from that of certain workings and certain accounts of magic being performed that is a bit more accurate, and that like many people have since tried out and found fairly good results with. But yeah, don't get caught up on the Viking stuff, because a lot of the staves are not Viking. Well, almost all the staves are not Viking. Even the Vegvísir, like this, what people refer to as the Viking compass. This is not Viking. It's not a compass. It's a stave. It's actually from 1860. So like, it's a lot later. It does what it says it does, but it's not ancient Viking magic. So I'd caution people not to get caught up on that, because also even the idea of the four Landvættir, like the four protector spirits of Iceland, that represent the cardinal directions, that's most likely from the four evangelists, and these later like Christian ideas, or these Christian interpretations of how the spirits here, could fit into a certain box that was more socially acceptable as more Christian. I think that's a couple. Oh, actually, yes. Also, just one thing, not to discourage people, but I get this quite often, especially at workshops as well, when I'm talking to people in person. The term vulva, as like a word for what Wikipedia calls like a Norse witch or prophetess, like this is not, I wouldn't trust the Wikipedia article on many things, but like this is not, this is not an entirely accurate description of what this word is. This is a term that's like a very, very like special and often like pretty unique term to be gifted or bestowed upon you. You can't call yourself this. It's a bit like, so how a lot of people will start practicing some shamanic techniques, and they'll be like, oh, I'm a shaman now. And it's like, well,
And
that's
we're all
not,
cringing. Yes.
exactly, yeah. And it's very like that. Like, it has this huge cultural weight, and it has this there are certain criteria that you need to tick off, like having a community, like being taught by someone before you who has this title as well, certain things like that. Which is why in the book I give like a whole list of other terms, other words that sound, sound cool and fun, but are also much more accurate to what people are doing. That's another thing I would say of a caveat, I guess, don't jump straight into this using this term without really understanding the weight that it holds and what it really means.
Sure. Yeah, have some, have the respect to know what you're calling yourself and all of the rest. Yeah. So is there anything that I haven't asked about that you would like to get into?
So in this book, I've included, in the Icelandic folk magic book, I've included like a sort of expanded herbarium. So my previous book, Icelandic Plant Magic, it's focused mostly on the plants and how they work with staves and various things like that. This one's a bit wider, obviously, because it's more general folk magic. But I have included a bunch of plants that are not native to Iceland that I work with when I'm in the UK, when I'm in Sweden, other places as well, which respond really well to these staves and can be used as materia to carve various staves and symbols onto, which for me have had like great effect. So that's one thing where I've tried to give people outside of Iceland quite a few examples of how they can work materia that might be in their own area, so that people don't feel, for sure, don't feel as though they have to have, like, you don't have to have certain wood to carve staves onto. And the way that I've in the book, the way that I've broken these things down, I hope will encourage people to work out the sort of the virtues and maybe planetary rulers of various plants in their area, so that they can then look back and be like, oh, okay, this stave, the goal of this stave is much more jovial. So I'm going to use some herbs of Jupiter from within my own area to do that, to work that stave. Because these are just like loads of sigils and symbols and runes and everything. They're not bound to the land. You don't have to have Icelandic native grown plants to do these things. So I've tried to give people the tools to piece together their own workings, and also just really encourage people to experiment with it. Because that's, at least on my Patreon as well, that's one thing that I'm doing, is constantly posting, here's my experiment for this month, here's how it worked, here's my plant of the month. I haven't done plants of the month this year yet, but last year I was doing a plant every month that I was breaking down, testing out various ideas and workings and things like and then at the end of each year I do my review of, okay, so here's this, I've done this X amount of times this year, it's worked well this time not worked well this time, and try to be like as, because I'm a Capricorn in like five different placements, so I'm trying to be
Okay.
as I feel like I'm what's the word, like cosmically destined to be really methodical in everything all the
I don't hate it.
time.
I love I'm a, I've my background is in science, so I'm loving this,
Okay.
repetition and data gathering and stuff. Yeah, very cool.
Yeah, that's what I'm really encouraging people to do. Because also I feel like the more you do stuff yourself, and the more you see it work, and the more you know how to specifically work things, the easier everything becomes. Because you work out what the building blocks are for these various workings, and you can piece other workings together from various parts of the workings that you already know, because you know how they fit together and how they work together.
Yeah,
So that's what
absolutely.
I've tried to do in this book.
Very cool. Yeah, I think there's a lot that people will enjoy in it, even if they don't decide to do any of the magic in it. I enjoy just hearing about all of the history and just the way that the tradition has been influenced by so many different things and how similar what you and I get up to are, even though we're looking at different lenses, perhaps. So I think that that's yeah, there's a lot there, and I think people are really going to enjoy it if they check it out. So, do you have any questions for me, Albert?
I mean, I guess I would have said, "What do you think about the book?"
Well, I love it. I really do. Yeah, I really love it. And I'm likely to buy myself a hard copy when it's available. And so,
Nice,
yeah, I'm into it.
nice.
So, where can people find your work?
So I'm on social media, on Instagram at Sussex underscore Pella, which I get a lot of questions about, because they see that I live in Iceland and they don't realize I'm from Sussex, and they see I use the word Pella, which is a Cornish word and not a word from Sussex. But I didn't want to call myself British Cunning Man, because that sounded really arrogant if people didn't understand what cunning folk and what a cunning man was. So I went with Sussex Pella. But that is, yeah, that's my Instagram. I'm also on Patreon as Sussex Pella as well. Patreon, I go a bit more into stuff than I do on Instagram, because it's much more of an interactive platform for me. And people are testing out experiments that I do as well, which I love. I love seeing what other people are doing, because I absolutely love, sorry, also just as a side note, if people have tried out various things and they've not worked, I also love to hear about that, because then I'm like, okay, let's discuss the method and work out how our results were so different. Because I just feel like the more you do that, the more well-rounded what you're doing becomes.
Yeah, absolutely. I've learned way more about magic from the things that ended up going sideways than the things that ended up working out really well. So that totally makes sense.
Nice. Instagram, social, Facebook as well. I'm on Facebook as Albert Bjørnskjul, Bjorn, and people are free to add me there as well. I don't tend to use Facebook as much, but if people have specific questions, they're able, feel free to add me on Facebook and ask me as well. I think that's everything for social media.
All right, great on. And we'll put links to all of that stuff in the show notes. Do you have any last words of advice or thoughts that you would like to leave the listeners and I with?
Yeah, I think on this theme of being scientific in your approach, yeah, make note of everything that you're doing, every working that you try. I personally would be quite thorough in making notes of, today is a Monday, I started this working in the hour of this planet. I try to keep a diary of workings, so that I know, roughly like where my head was at as well, like emotionally, or what sort of headspace I was in when I was doing this working, like what time it was, what the goal was. Because I'm also like, if I'm doing some sort of work for something that's a bit more vague, I can look back at it and be like, oh, okay, now I know I could specialize, or like more sort of, yeah, specialize what I'm doing into something a bit more specific. So I would say be methodical with your approach, and be as like science minded as you can, and make notes of all the variables in all of your experiments, because it really helps.
Right on. I love this. And, as somebody who also likes to look at stinky old grimoires and stuff, I feel like we do owe it to the magicians who will come after us to write some of this stuff down, because that's how we found it too. So,
Absolutely.
well, Albert, thank you so much. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Absolutely. Yeah, this has been great. Thank you for having me.
All right, thanks so much to Alvar Schill for joining me. Find links in the show notes to Crossed Crow Books, where Icelandic folk magic, Witchcraft of the North, can be purchased, as well as to Albert's website, where you can see his courses and other offerings. I was thinking about what Albert told me, how Freya, the love goddess, is the one who is said to have taught Odin the art of Sidir. It reminds me of the idea from the Tarot of the High Priestess being the one who sort of opens the gates of the mysteries to the seeker. I know, sort of errant thought to consider there. I also wanted to mention that I think the answer to the bibliomancy break from earlier is yes, especially since the Lord's Prayer came up in it. Nice companion episode to the one that you have heard and are still enjoying would be number 48, The Five Pillars of Consent with Zag Budd and Odin and Inclusive Heathenry with Lonnie Scott. You can hear more about the enigmatic figure that is Odin. Really stoked to tell you all about a group magical working I have planned coming up for the new moon. I'm going to be getting to that in a couple minutes, as well as getting into some updates about the Green Mushroom Project and listener mail and shoutouts. But let me remind you first that if you like the show and you're into what we've got going on over here, you can support it on Patreon, which will entitle you to receive a bibliomancy reading from me. Making this show is a pretty wild amount of work, especially for just one intrepid podcaster as myself, but it means a lot to me to be able to do it. Thank you so much to the people who are making that possible by giving on Patreon or Buy Me a Coffee, and to the people who are supporting the show by spreading the word. It's very helpful. Tell your friends, your allies, your magical associates, as well as everybody you meet at the next ceremonial potluck you attend. You can also post about it on social media or write a positive review where that is possible. Both of these things are super helpful, so thank you very much to everybody who is already doing that. And yes, don't forget to smash the shit out of that follow or alarm button or whatever it is so that you can get updates when new episodes come out. All right, some cool updates to share with you about what we've got planned for the Green Mushroom Project. Laurel, aka Lullaby, will be giving a chat about building and maintaining relationships with spirits tonight as this episode comes out. And next week, we're going to be getting into some mineralogy as Laura presents on the topic of stones of interest. I love it. I'm a huge geology nerd. We're having an art contest right now on the server to choose a new banner. We have a ton of talented people around, and this is a sort of fun way to showcase that. So if you're a visual artist and you want to enter the contest, check out the server to see how. Thank you so much to everybody who made it out to the presentation I gave the other day about the founding of the Green Mushroom Hyphosigil Project and some of the rationale that went into that, as well as about our new project, Void House, which is an experiment that we're launching to create a new inclusive, consent-forward magical space in which to do more, personal or serious or vulnerable work, both in person and online. Things kind of investigating what I like to sometimes call void states or whatever. And also, other types of liminalities and the circumstances that require that, of course. Also for providing educational materials and spaces for discussions. I outlined the objectives and plans for building and visiting Void House and talked about some of the resources we'll be looking at as we put something robust together in terms of education. If you weren't able to make it but are curious about the project, fret not. A video of the presentation will be available within the next few weeks. Lots of stuff to get through, but that is on the docket. On Thursday, May 23rd, I'll be hosting the second to last iteration of our 23 Bibliomancy experiment, something I've been organizing to discover the Green Mushroom Project scripture. On the 23rd of every month, participants bring the book that they feel wants to participate, and we combine the 23rd line of the 23rd page into a sort of giant cut-up using dice rolls to figure out what order things will be arranged in. It's been a really fascinating thing to put together so far. If you've wanted to participate in this but haven't gotten the chance yet, now is a great time to hop in as we prepare to complete the text. A slight divergence here, another thing that was going to be happening on May 23rd is the release of the next episode of this podcast, which will feature a very rad conversation I had with Michael M. Hughes about his experiences creating a spell to bind a certain political and TV figure that wound up becoming a sort of viral sensation, and kind of interesting stuff there. We'll get into his book about magical activism, as well as talking about some of the history of that, as well as the tarot, his own history with chaos magic, and much more. He was very patient with me as I led him down a sort of rabbit hole I've been spending a lot of time in recently, involving the UAP phenomena, hypersigils, and the dangers of art the ancients warned us about. Very stoked to share the conversation. Sort of related to both this conversation and the Mushroom Project, returning to updates about that, on June 8th, I'm going to be running a ritual which will take place both locally here at the Little Pagan Guild that I'm a part of, as well as remotely with people in the Mushroom Project and others if they want to participate. If you're a local person who's a member of the circle, join us in person Saturday, June 8th, as I bring some classic tech as well as some brand new stuff I've written for the occasion to a high-powered ceremony I'm putting together about sending protection to vulnerable people, children close to home who need some extra help, as well as those elsewhere who are being impacted by the war and genocide and other factors, as well as others who are being impacted by shifting political tides and other things like that. If you're not able to attend locally, as most people who hear this, of course, are not going to be, but you'd like to participate, I've come up with an easy way for people to help out. On Saturday, June 8th at 9 p.m. Eastern, simply carry out the simple spell work that I've outlined and included in the show notes. Basically, it's just saying the statement of intent, a psalm I've written, the Green Mushroom Project statement of resistance, and lighting a candle. So yeah, real simple stuff, real accessible for anybody that wants to participate. We've got a lot of other rad things planned for the Mushroom Project, as well as the regular rune study group and book club. We're right now slowly enjoying Six Ways by Aidan Wachter, which has been very fun. We've also rescheduled our Bicycle Day chat about chemonosis, and that's going to be taking place on May 24th. Come and check out our server for all of the lists and updates about what we've got going on. All right, let's do listener mail and shoutouts. All right, shout out to Tad P. Freely on Instagram. I really appreciate the kind words. Fuck yeah. Shout out to Rocket, who I'm taking a really cool class co-taught by them called Faces of Oppression, Faces of Liberation, Untangling the Intersections of Anti-Semitism, White Supremacy, and Transphobia, which has been super helpful and interesting in trying to find context for a lot of things. You can hear Rocket in episode 70 of the show, Spinoza and the Sexy Dangers of Pantheism, Transdivinity, and Agdistis with Rocket. Shout out to Christopher on Instagram, who hit me up about the Gateway tapes. We're talking about maybe doing some experiments with things along these lines in the fall. We'll see if there's interest. Shout out also to Mr. Human, who answered the Spotify poll I put out about what arises when you think of the void. Mr. Human answers, an inky darkness vibrating and coiling with potential. Sounds I haven't heard. Colors I haven't seen. And the depth of imagination and the subconscious. Fuck yeah, I love it. Shout out and thank you so much to everybody who wrote and sent me stuff that I didn't mention. I'm not always organized enough to mention everybody who I wish I could, but I really appreciate the support and enthusiasm for the show and my other work and for y'all sharing about the cool stuff that you're doing. Fuck yeah. If you'd like to send me thoughts, questions, comments, or suggestions for listener mail, you can reach me at luxoccultpod@gmail.com or get me on Instagram at luxoccultpod. All right, I'm going to close things out here by sharing with you the psalm that I was, given to be part of the protection ritual that I'll be running soon. I will follow that with the Green Mushroom Project Statement of Resistance and bid you all a farewell. Okay, this is Psalm 608, written by me. Praise be to the lady who strides across the skies and dances with the waves. For she has lifted me up above my troubles. She has, with tenderness, shepherded me through the tribulations placed in my path by wickedness. She has broken the chains that hobbled my heart, freeing it to soar with gladness. She has written the symphony which resounds in my breast. Watchful and wise, our mother who is in all realms has set feasts of delicacies before me. I am nourished by her grace. I am sheltered by her mercy. I am humbled by her splendor. Hear the song my heart is singing for you, dear lady. I am grateful for your guidance. I am thankful for your light. May the melody of my devotion draw you nearer to me still, so that you would walk to me and beside me along the paths these chords key, delivering unto me the instruments of this exaltation. Lead these delights they offer to my door. Stand guard over the threshold of our house, mother. Open the path to your supplicants, your children. Close the ways forever to wickedness. Let the circle of your safety be as a serpent which swallows its own tail. Resist. Resist by maintaining sovereignty of the self. Resist by maintaining love of the self. Resist by maintaining fierce loyalty to love and pleasure. Resist with acts of radical kindness. Focus on the path to better times. Fuck yeah. Thanks so much to Albert Bjornskiel and Omega Decay for joining me. Thanks to everybody who has assisted, both seen and unseen. And most of all, thanks so much to you for listening. This is Lux Estrada, reminding you to stay strong and stay fucking curious. Alright, I'm gonna leave you with something from the Green Mushroom Project and Wheel Hollowed digital mixtape. Thanks so much to everybody who contributed tracks to that. This is Magnetic Displet by Nahadoth.
Lux Occult is a part of the Green Mushroom Podcast Network.
What scares you?
Ghosts.
Aliens.
Monsters.
The occult.
Conspiracies.
Some of you like to be scared, and unearthing paranormalcy is for you.
Some of you try everything you can to avoid it. Unearthing paranormalcy is for you.
We take the topics that scare some, and we dig in to find the source, then present the history to make the paranormal a little more normal.
We also throw in a bit of comedy to shed a light on some of the darkness in the world.
So whether you're scared of bumps in the night, what's inside your own mind, or strange lights in the sky, we cover it all.
We dig in and present all that we find and try to come up with some logical
and not so logical
reasons for the high strangeness happenings.
Sometimes we are scared of the things we don't understand, and the more we understand, the less we fear.
So find us, Unearthing Paranormalcy, on your favorite podcast app, and join us on Facebook, Instagram, and Discord at UMP Normalcy. And until next time,
keep digging.